Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We are talking about the science behind smiling. Are you a smiler? I'm one of those people who smiles maybe too much. I've got a smile on my face most of the time, and maybe my guest today can help me help analyze that for me and maybe for you as well. Paula Niedenthal, our guest today. She is the founder of the Niedenthal Emotions Lab at UW-Madison. Research lab that investigates the social function, the physiological basis, the cultural shapers of human emotion, expression, and experience. So are you a smiley person? Tell us about the time when you visited another country, maybe. What did you notice about the way the people there showed their emotions? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Paula Niedenthal, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning. Thanks for your interest.
Well, we have... We both have smiles on our faces.
We do. Once you smile, I smile back. That's kind of a normal rule. Mimicking smiles is a big thing.
Do people who know your work, are they ever self-conscious about that? How should I smile when I'm around Paula?
Sometimes they are self-conscious. They ask me if I'm analyzing their smiles. They also, it depends who they are. Like, doctors can get really self-conscious because if they are plastic surgeons or people who reconstruct the smile, because I know I know a lot about that. So there are certain people who are more anxious about it than others.
So why is it important to study this, you know, emotional expression?
Well, I sometimes call this the most consequential facial expression and also the most nuanced facial expression. There are many, many answers to your question, running from health to cultural interaction and international relations. Probably the most urgent part of this is that people actually have a lot of stereotypes and prior beliefs about smiling that they use to judge other people. And so learning about what smiles mean and when we use them and how they vary cross-culturally influences, once again, everything from how we think about reconstructing the smile to how we use the smile in interaction in, across the world, across the globe.
Across the world.
Yep.
I laughed out loud when I saw an item in a news story about you, which was quoting the Norwegian government as saying that if you're in Norway, if they see somebody who's with a big smile, they're either drunk or crazy or American or all three.
Yeah. This is what I meant earlier when I said that people have a lot of prior beliefs about smiling. Yeah, that there is a very different frequency in smiling in the United States, and in fact, in all of the Americas, than there are in certain other countries of the world, and interpretations vary accordingly. Yeah.
Marina in West Salem has something I think relates right to this that we're talking about here. Marina, hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to share something with you when you were talking about smile for a topic. My dad had a smile poem on the back of his business card that he handed out to so many people. And if you give me 1 minute, I could read it to you. It has a nice message. It's called Smile. A smile costs nothing but creates much. It happens in a flash, but the memory of it can last forever. A smile is of no earthly good to anyone until it is freely given away. So if you meet someone who does not have a smile, give them one of yours, because no one needs a smile as much as those who have none to give.
Ooh.
Nice. Yeah, I would agree. Although you have to be careful cross cultures.
Maureen, thanks a lot.
That was really nice. Yeah,
that was really nice. Smiles can show a whole range of emotions, can't they? You've certainly studied that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I'm going to step up one step before your question, which
sure.
is do smiles always accompany emotion? And not necessarily. Facial expressions sometimes convey emotion, but they can also just be there to regulate our environment socially, but non-verbally. So you can make a smile that says you're a safe, open to affiliation person without saying I'm sending you a feeling or conveying a particular feeling to you, like happiness. Saying I'm open and safe is not really an emotional signal. It's a more social regulational signal. And so, you know, the issue is here is asking about, does that smile actually accompany an emotion, or is it serving a function beyond that emotion? For example, take embarrassment. We often smile when we're embarrassed. The smile part of embarrassment is not always about I'm conveying embarrassment to you with my smile, but more an attempt to be ingratiating to you or be taken back into your higher esteem. People like people who express their embarrassment, and the smile that comes with it allows them to go like, okay, you recognize what you did wrong, and now I like you again. But that's not specifically saying I'm embarrassed, more like I want you to accept me into everything, like your social network. So yes, we can say that smiles accompany many emotions, but that's not necessarily what they're specifically signaling, that emotion. They might be signaling what to do about it. They might be signaling what you'd like the person to do now that you've recognized that emotion or whatever. So they're pretty complicated in that sense.
I saw some photos of you with with the various types of smiles.
Yeah. I don't do those well on command. I do know that I do them automatically, though. Right. In my laboratory, we study in particular what we call smiles of reward, which is what we do when we like what the other person said or did, or we want to encourage that nonverbal infant to do, something again. We have smiles that I call smiles of affiliation, which are similar to what I was just talking about. That's where you say, don't worry about me. I know we're in this tiny elevator together, but I'm safe. It's okay. Mm-hmm. The sort of more like reassurance or non-threat smile. And we also study smiles that we call smiles of dominance, which signal that we are in a position of higher status at this moment or regarding this topic.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do we ever smile when we're really angry? And we're going to talk about anger later on. Do we ever smile when we're angry?
Well, once again, when you smile while you're angry, it may be because you are thinking about the pleasure you will have in something that you did regarding that anger. So we wouldn't say it's a smile of anger. We would say smiling during anger because of, a plan or a planned behavior or an imagination of the outcome of the behavior that we're doing. So, yeah, we could definitely smile during anger.
I am smiling because I'm thinking about what I might do to that person.
Right, exactly. That's what I meant. Exactly. I'm smiling because I know what I'm going to do about this now.
Man. What is it? I'm sure I know you've studied smiling and its effect on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
What's the effect?
Again, it depends a little bit on what kind of smile it is. But what's interesting about our brains and our faces is that they have connections. So the brain can tell the face to make facial expressions. And then when the expression is made, the brain can feel the way the face moved, so to speak. That's sort of simplifying it, to know kind of what we just did down there. And so that's a really interesting connection. It means that when we return somebody else's smile and their smile means they're happy, then we're returning it by mimicking it. And then our brain can feel that we mimicked this smile that represents a lot of pleasure and a lot of happiness. And our brain centers that are that represent reward will be activated during that time. So mimicking somebody's smile that is a happy smile will make us happy to some degree as well.
Dean from Redcliffe called in but couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if animals also smile.
It a little bit depends on the definition. I mean, we would all say that it looks like canines have things called smiles, or we might look at a pig and say that facial expression looks like a smile. We are more certain about the use of smiles and its similarity to human smiles in non-human primates, such as chimpanzees. So yes, we think they smile. Do we think they smile because they're happy or they're regulating their environment with that smile? We don't know about things like dogs, and we have a little bit of more clarity about the non-human primates that are closer to us.
So how does gender impact the perception? I want to talk about perceptions a little bit too of smiles. How does our gender impact the perceptions others have of our smile?
Quite a bit, because we have a lot of sort of norms and expectations that differ by gender categories as they currently or have been defined, such that if somebody identifies and presents as a male, we have a lot of expectations. We don't have as much expectation of them smiling. That's not sort of a social task that men are largely charged with. But as your speaker later in the show will say, we have different expectations about men expressing anger. With regard to women, though, we have a lot of expectation that they should smile and that they have a burden to smile. It's suggesting that they're caretaking. It suggests that they're pleasant. It gets related to the perception of femininity and female roles. So there is a large expectation. We do not perceive men and women smiling in the same way, and we don't have expectations for them to smile equally often or even in the same situations. And when I teach my undergraduates about this, they sometimes wonder whether those gender roles and attendant stereotypes have changed over time and that I'm just a really old person teaching an old idea. But, you know, as recently as last year, research in Germany is particularly focusing on Angela Merkel and other politicians suggested very clearly that Angela Merkel, the former chancellor of Germany, was expected to smile and was essentially punished in socially for expressing negative expressions rather than smiling. So this is not an old problem. It continues that we expect women to smile a lot and a lot more than we expect men or people who present as men.
Every morning I do a jog for about 3 miles in the neighborhood, and I always smile at everybody and say, "Good morning." And, you know, it's interesting. There is a different reaction between men and women, let's say, who I meet. Although over time it changes, because I say see kind of the same people every morning. But guys are less likely to. I mean, guys just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, women are more likely to make eye contact, to mimic your smile, to exchange your smile. Yeah.
I always keep going. I never stop. I don't want to be, too forward about it, but I do like to, I mean, that's the way I like to start my day.
Yeah. Well, it probably makes you feel good for the rest of your day and other people as well.
Helen from West Salem. She says her Irish setter smiled, which, you know, you look at Patricia McConnell's done a lot of research on this, an animal behaviorist who's also a good friend of mine, and they smile, they frown. It sure looks like it to me anyway.
Dogs, yeah.
Dogs.
Yeah, our problem is we haven't mapped that out completely with regard to what the underlying state or the intention of that smile is. What is the effect on everybody else? What is the effect on the other animal? So I don't think we know everything about that yet. So I feel like I'm waiting for the answer on what the meaning. I believe that dogs smile, and I'm waiting to see if they are using them similarly to humans. There's certainly data that suggests that they would use them similarly to humans over domestication.
Our guest today, Paula Niedenthal, who a researcher at the UW-Madison. She studies smiles, among other things. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Had an experience, a good or bad one, relating to a smile? Other questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Lots of good emails today. ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Taking a look at the cultural and social functions of smiles on the show today. Larry Mueller here, my guest Paula Niedenthal, a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Psychology, founder of the Niedenthal
Emotions Lab.
Emotions Lab, yeah. My emotions went crazy there as I was trying to remember the exact title of it. Anyway, questions for her or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Michael emailed us, how well do humans distinguish a genuine smile from a disingenuous or deceitful one?
Wow, that has been a topic, in research for a very long time. And there's not a single answer to how well. Part of the problem is that some cultures really don't distinguish between what we would in the United States call a fake and a true smile, in the sense that we have in the past believed that certain features of the face are present or certain muscles are contracted during a smile of what we would say is true pleasure or true happiness. Although, as I just mentioned earlier, that we don't always smile when we're happy. So this kind of confuses this entire project. So what if we call a smile a fake smile, a smile that's covering a negative feeling or an intention, which could also be called a masking smile. People can be pretty good at knowing that that's a masking smile, that it doesn't reflect underlying feelings of happiness. But like I said, this actually varies across culture. It also varies across people, because some people actually take in all the information and some people, for example, avoid making eye contact and miss some of the information. Yeah. And so there's really not one answer to that.
Mary in Sheboygan has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. Larry, like you, I'm a person that smiles a lot, and it's been a habit of a lifetime just about. But one of the things I didn't realize that I was doing was, first thing in the morning, I get up, go to the bathroom, and turn on the light and look in the mirror, and I smile at my own reflection. And it only became apparent to me that I was doing this a few years ago, but I realized that. And what it means is that even if I don't see anybody else the rest of the day, I've had at least one person smile back at me.
Whoa.
Oh.
That's a great strategy. I mean, I think we should use that as a therapy.
I love that. I love the way you think, Mary. That's a good way to think, isn't it?
I think it's excellent.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate that call. You lived in France part of your life in France, at least. And during that time, you asked people what they thought of Americans.
I asked and I got answers even if I wasn't asking. there are lots of countries. There are, people vary enormously across country in their use of smiles and their expectations for smiles. They even vary enormously in their understanding of the history of this facial expression, which is actually pretty interesting and rich. Many, older world countries, smiling frequency is a little bit lower. And I think that research in my laboratory reveals a lot about why that's true. But I did learn in France and many other countries of Europe in particular that there is an association in people's minds between sales and capitalism and dentistry and American smiles. And so many of them are seen as essentially inauthentic sales tactics. So I did hear that very, very often. Yeah.
Oh, and I was fascinated by the differences among countries. A country, let's go back to Norway for a minute.
Sure.
Where smiling isn't, people don't smile as much, as opposed to the United States. And a lot of that has to do with the cultures.
Yeah, so it is interesting, right? Instead of judging each other's smile frequency, which other people do, not you specifically, it is interesting to understand why in one culture or one region of the world people would smile more than others without making an immediate judgment. I had a postdoc from Germany, and we were talking about this, and he said, in Germany we tend to, and of course he can't speak for all Germans, my husband's German as well, he sort of said, and this is kind of harkens back to the reading we heard at the beginning of the show. He sort of said, in Germany, we sort of reserve our smiles for close friends and family. And my response was, but they're free. So I think they should just be given all the time. Like, I don't really see why. And that we were sort of joking, comparing cultures. What my research suggests is that a really large predictor or an important phenomenon in the prediction of how frequently people smile and even how they use them has to do with the migratory history of the region of the world we're talking about. So that could be a country like the United States versus Norway has a completely different migratory history for reasons that also involve, negative experiences for some groups, obviously. The United States has been populated over its history by people from many, many, many different countries who initially didn't share anything about emotion in the sense that they couldn't talk about emotion, and they might not even have the same expectations about other people's displays of emotion. So in a place like the United States or Canada or Brazil, you have people from all over the world settling repeatedly in that location and not sharing language and not sharing expectations and norms. Over history, what you might do is to develop a pressure on nonverbal communication because you initially don't share all these things.
Yeah.
And so the research that I've conducted suggests that essentially the more different countries of the world that have contributed to the population of where you live over history, that might be 250 years in the United States or longer, but we track it since the beginning of the census of the United States, or all over the world, which could be at least 500 years when the Portuguese developed maps and people started to colonize. So that's what I mean by negative experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that if your country is largely populated over history by the same ethnic group, and Norway is the case, and now people would say that they've received a lot of migrants and refugees. That's true, but that's recent history. I'm talking about 500 years. So our data show that the more pressure there is to communicate over history with people who don't share your language or your expectations about emotion, the more your culture develops a tendency to use nonverbal behavior, be more expressive facially, and maybe even need to use different kinds of smiles that I described in order to differentiate between responses in social situations. And that's what our data show. Across the United States, the states vary in their migratory history. What we see is that places with high diverse migratory history, like the Great Lakes states or New York or California, we see a lot of smiling and a lot of transparency in facial expression. And other parts of the country that have lower diversity of migration or over history show not quite as much transparency and use of smiles.
You know, I was born in Stoughton, Wisconsin, and I know all kinds of Norwegians who have big smiles on their faces all the time.
Because they had to interact with people who didn't speak Norwegian. My mom grew up in McFarland, and it's the same. You would expect that in fact, some of my ideas came from reading the Little House on the Prairie books, which involve all of these people we're talking about.
Yeah.
What you had to do was go to the grain elevator and unload wheat or whatever. Or in Dane County, you had to manage tobacco. And you had to interact with somebody who was from Poland or from somebody from Germany or somebody from Ireland. And you had to become more facially expressive, at least in the moment. That doesn't, of course, mean that somebody who's ethnically Norwegian is going to be as smiley as some other somebody with another background, because there are other reasons that people smile beyond this need to communicate with others.
Let's go to Landon in Mount Horeb. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Here's another Norwegian call-in from the Mount Horeb area today, actually, with great-grandparents who immigrated from Stoughton as well. So I was just calling, and I was just listening to the station, and I recalled a show that I watched CBS Sunday Morning maybe a year or two ago, and there was a couple that was being interviewed, and one of the things that was mentioned by one of the members of the couple, he was of Native American background, and he was married to his husband, who was of more of a white Anglo-Saxon background, and they drew a stark contrast between the white Caucasian member of the couple, who always smiled and spoke very nicely and asked people about themselves, while the Native American member of the couple always found that very weird and said that we tend to, and people in my family showed our emotions the way that we were truly feeling. We wouldn't posture with all of these, like, inadvertent sort of smiles that really didn't mean anything all the time. I thought that was interesting that that had come up in your research and what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Comments on that, Paula?
Yeah, I haven't actually heard that story before, and so I'm afraid I'm not going to have an incredibly interesting answer to that, except that it is definitely the case that sub-communities within the if we're just taking the United States, we could talk about a world answer to that, but within the United States, the extent to which you're going to be influenced by the culture, for example, this need for the for members or members of the population who actually emigrated from elsewhere will probably be influenced by or have tasks to assimilate that are really different from a Native American community that has a completely coherent and functional, before influences outside of their control, a Native American community and culture would have their own rules and they would need to, and they would be developing functional rules for getting along. Now, because that culture is more coherent than essentially a melting pot, and I'm using that loosely, then words for emotion, expectations for emotion, and norms for emotion would be coherent within that culture, and needing to use emotions to regulate more ethnically, racially, and every other kind of diversity, diverse contexts would not be present. So I guess I would argue that this makes sense from a concept of a highly historically diverse population versus a culturally coherent, which would be similar, for example, to the Norwegians in Norway, at least over most of history. So you would be calling the Native American culture and community a coherent one without high ancestral diversity, and you would call the member of this couple who's Caucasian American, potentially European American, would have had all of these other influences and needs to use their facial expression in a completely different assimilation kind of way than a Native American community.
Susan in Vilas County emailed us, have you studied the mechanism where emotions translate to the muscle movements necessary to smile or frown? The mechanism where emotions translate to the muscle movements.
Well, what happens during an emotional state is a whole system in the brain. Lots and lots of things are going on. And there are reasons that are evolutionarily ancient why certain experiences of emotion, that would be your internal subjective state or your feelings, would be related to making a gesture on your face. There are old historical reasons, evolutionary reasons for that. For example, it's often considered that the facial expression of disgust has evolved to eject toxic or contaminating things from the mouth or from the nose and prevent further ingestion of whatever that toxin is. So over history, those two things get, or over evolution, those two things get strongly associated. The interior experience of disgust, that is, you've either tasted or smelled something that's grotesque, and then the facial expression. We have we have two cranial nerves, one that feeds the muscles of the face and one that returns information from the muscles of the face. And so we do know about the association between emotions and the expression, and we know also about how the anatomy of the brain and the physiology of the brain allows that feeling to be associated with the contractions of particular muscles on the face.
Steve emailed us, we'll keep on this a bit here. Somewhere he read that by holding a pencil in your mouth sideways, your facial muscles are forced to mimic a smile, and this in turn creates the same positive benefits physiologically of an actual smile.
Yeah,
he's tried it and it seems to work. And yep. I'm sure that he did not sharpen the pencil before he put it in.
No, I would just sort of fix that the description a little bit. I mean, sometimes people this is research strategy to get people to smile without telling them to smile. Right. What you sometimes do is you say here, and then I'm going to describe this slightly differently from the caller. You ask somebody to put a pencil longwise into their mouth and to bite their teeth on the body of the pencil, but it's not sticking sideways, it's sticking out of their mouth. What that does is, if you tell them, don't touch your lips to the pencil, hold it in your teeth, what happens is you make a smile.
Yeah,
right?
I'm trying.
You're doing
it
right now. I'm looking at you. He's doing a good job. And some people have used that as a way to create a natural smile. It doesn't always work, but it certainly is better than frowning. Mm-hmm. And if you are willing to accept it and you engage in how you feel, sure, it can have certain kinds of positive influences.
So there was another point that I wanted to bring up, too, that you've looked at and have different levels of, and that's vagal, I think it's vagal tone. Mm-hmm. Is that how you call it? That mm-hmm. people that are very expressive and smile a lot have a higher vagal tone?
Yeah.
And what is it? What is the vagal?
Whoa, really? You want to go there? Okay, let's go. When we use the word vagal tone, what we're referring to is the balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. What human beings can do, and certain animals, but we're pretty good at doing this, is some people better than others, is to block our flight or fight response, which is coming from the sympathetic nervous system, by applying or balancing the activation of that system, which, as I said, leads you to fight or flight, with the parasympathetic nervous system, which kind of calms you down. And what I'll say is simply is that to the extent that you can do that well and appropriately to the situation, for example, you said that sometimes joggers are unclear about what your smile means, but if you smiled at me in the studio, I should be pretty clear about what that smile means. So I shouldn't get anxious that you smiled. However, people who haven't seen a lot of smiles or are not sure what that smile means in the situation need to take fight or flight if it's a threatening smile. And so what people who have good vagal tone can do is moderate their arousal to facial expression and also manage the production, that is the display, of their mm-hmm. own facial expressions pretty well. Because exchanging information about emotions and other social intentions with the face requires pretty good control over arousal. An evolutionary, a long time ago, we might not have been very happy to receive a smile from somebody we didn't know, and we might attack, and there might be good reasons to do that. But now there are not. And so, not always. And so, our physiology can help us respond appropriately and take appropriate action when we're engaged with somebody, somebody's emotions and somebody's facial expressions.
Next year, I'm going to be playing golf. I'm hoping I'll be playing golf in Scotland.
Oh, nice.
And I guess I'm wondering, and let's make it more general, when you go somewhere else, like Scotland or Norway or wherever it is, should we learn a little bit more about this sort of thing before we go?
I think we should.
Yeah.
Because, and in turn, other places learn as well. There have been many, many initiatives that cost millions of dollars or whatever the national currency is to teach people about smiles. When the World Cup soccer games were in Russia, they had smile training because there was a recognition that people would indeed believe that the other person was either inappropriate or not mentally stable if they were smiling all the time. They recognized that there could be a problem in terms of international interaction within the World Cup soccer games. In addition, they had a smile campaign in Paris to teach people about the need to smile to welcome international tourists in service situations. There's training in East Asian countries about the use of smiles in the United States and in other of the Americas in business transaction. And it really helps people stop judging each other or making predictions that are inaccurate or unuseful for that particular culture. And in general, people should do as the Romans do. They should understand that whatever they're doing is adapted to their culture, and maybe they should do the culturally appropriate thing in another culture rather than either judging or insisting. That's what I generally think, because the smiles are adaptations.
So someone from a less smiley country and you're there, you should behave as they behave.
And find out from them what is appropriate, because smiles can cause a lot of problems.
So what professions would benefit from learning more about this whole thing?
Thank you for asking. I think that business, health, and education, all of those careers and all of those contexts have been using smiles in many ways. In business, we know a lot about positive emotion, smiling, and performance. So in management, smile is really important. In marketing, smiles are used for everything from the Olympics to different kinds of perfumes to experiences at water parks. And understanding better about the role of what smiles are and what they mean is hugely important in marketing. In all sorts of health-related industries, the smile is incredibly important. Dentistry is too obvious, but in recreating facial expression through plastic and reconstructive surgery, worrying about repairing cleft palate, these things all involve knowing something structural and physiological about the smile. But the smile also affects things like the development of social networks and also our own neurochemistry. And so for almost all health-related areas, learning about and understanding the physiology and the social implications of smiling is important. And finally, if you go to even elementary schools, have posters that encourage people to smile. And so we also have been thinking a lot about, you know, what is the nature of smile as a reward? What does it do for ambiance within learning and other kinds of issues within learning and educational environments? So I see this as really important, way beyond academia and international relations into business, health, and education.
And should any of us, if you see someone who's not smiling, say, oh, why don't you smile?
I think charging people to smile is probably not a good idea. As you're going to learn in the second portion of this program today, there is a reason when people get angry. There is a signal. That's a meaningful thing to express anger. And so, you know, telling somebody, for example, who's grieving or who has a reason to be angry to smile, I think would be, you know, inappropriate. However, if that is a smiley person no longer smiling, then you would check in with them.
Real pleasure, Paula.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Thank you so much taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I learned a little bit, and I think our listeners did as well. Maybe I learned a lot. I don't know. We'll find out more how much I've learned a bit, I think, as we take a look at our next part, our next segment, which has to do with anger. But in the meantime, Paula Niedenthal, great to have her with us, professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have her with us. Maybe we'll get her back. She's got a big smile on her face.
So. Thanks for your interest.
So she might be amenable since she was smiling. All right, there we go. Let's turn to anger next. That's next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.